Let's get together, talk about the movies that we saw this week. We'll have discussions, talk film news, we'll laugh a lot and act like geeks. Sometimes we'll have a guest or two, sometimes it's just the two of us. Let's crack some jokes and tell some folks to come along and hang with us!
Mike and Mike go to the movies. Mike and Mike go to the movies.
Yeah!
You have chosen wisely.
Hello and welcome to a podcast driven into madness and depravity thanks to the sin of lust. It's Mike and Mike Go to the Movies. I'm Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man on a mission to protect the hive.
Mike DiCriccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing great. Maybe I wish I was driven to insanity by the sin of lust instead of protecting the hive, you know?
You think I should have swapped those around?
I wouldn't have been mad.
Fair enough. We are recording this, it's Super Bowl Sunday, Mike.
And yes.
It's the day of the big game. We're recording this a little bit early because I had plans on Tuesday, our normal recording day. And so, yeah, this will be out on Thursday. I don't know why I'm going into the actual specifications of when we're recording, but just so everyone knows, right after this, we're going to eat a lot of food and watch the football game.
Yeah, so we won't be able to comment on who won. Go team, go sports team, I guess. Congrats to them.
Right. We know you look to Mike and Mike Go to the Movies for all your sports coverage.
Yes.
And so that's why we're not going to be able to cover the Super Bowl because it hasn't happened yet for us.
Yeah, we apologize to all the listeners.
Exactly. Yeah, what's been going on with you, Mike D? What's been going on in your life?
Not a whole lot, honestly. Working, waiting for time when I'll be off, basically. I've got some plans coming up in the next few weeks. So I'm ready for that, ready to have not work, you know? What about you, Mike?
Fair enough. Yeah, no, pretty much the same. Just chilling, working and stuff. I do want to mention that, you know, this episode comes out on Thursday, which means as of, you know, this being released, the poll for season 4 of The Complete Works is live right now.
That's right.
So you can place your votes if you haven't yet to see who we'll be covering on season 4 of The Complete Works. Your 4 finalists are Nicole Kidman, Walter Matthau, Kirsten Dunst, and Roy Scheider, which is just a wild, like, every time we bring it up, it's like, what a wild group of names that ended up being.
Yeah, what a weird combo, but I'm very proud of those 4. I think that really is the Mike and Mike way. You know, we just have a weird broad spectrum of people that we and stuff we enjoy.
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, that poll is live now. We are recording this before the poll went live, so we have no idea how it's doing at the moment. But and anything could be happening. Kidman could be way in the lead. It could be a 4-way tie. Anything could be going on.
Anything's possible. I noticed you didn't say that one of my people could be out in the lead. Interesting, Mike.
Yeah,
interesting.
The Matthau heads could be coming out, Mike. You never know.
He's got a real heavy Twitter presence.
Yeah, exactly. You have to find a bunch of 60-year-olds and get them on Twitter so they can vote in the poll.
Yeah, exactly.
They'll be your backing. They'll back you up. But yeah, so the Twitter poll is live right now. Go vote in that if you haven't yet. And today's episode of Mike and Mike is just a freewheeling discussions episode, just talking about some of the stuff that we have been watching lately. So let's get into it, Mike. It's time for some discussions.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for some discussions here on Mike and Mike Go to the Movies. Mike D, would you like to start us off with something you've been watching?
Sure. I'll start off with 2 animes that I've been watching. I mentioned one at the end of the Mike Makes Mike Watch episode last week at the end of our Spirited Away discussion, which is called Frieren Beyond Journey's End, which is about this adventuring party who at the very beginning of the episode 1 is returning from the end of their 10-year adventuring campaign where they slayed like the demon lord or whatever they call him. And so we don't see any of that adventure. And this is them wrapping up. They've ushered in an era of new peace in the world. And one of the characters, the main character, Frieren, is an elf. So she's functionally immortal. And so the whole show is basically just about her coming to terms with that. And like, hey, these people that she spent 10 years adventuring, to them, it's a majority of their life. You know, they are like this massive thing. And to her, it like is barely a blink of an eye. And within the first 20 minutes of the episode, like, oh, these people are all dead because they're ancient now. You know, everyone else except Frieren and sort of her coming to terms with that. And it's like really melancholy. melancholy and beautiful. And also when there is action, because it is like a fantasy thing, it's very exciting. So yeah, I've been really enjoying that. I watched a couple more episodes. I had only watched the first one when we recorded the Spirited Away Mike Makes Mike Watch episode. And yeah, I'm really into it. Having a lot of fun with that. And then I also started watching the first two episodes of a show on Netflix, which is called Delicious in Dungeon. And this is a very silly, funny idea to me. And it's another fantasy thing where it's, you know, a traditional adventuring fantasy D&D type story where there's this dungeon that has appeared in the world. And it's like a race to see which adventuring team can get to the bottom level first to unlock some kingdom. I don't even really know where it's going with that. But it seems like every time you die in the dungeon, you all of your loot, all of your gear drops off and you wake up at the top of the dungeon and you start over, right? And the very beginning of the episode, one of the characters' sister gets eaten by a dragon, but she hasn't died yet because the dragon takes a month to like digest because it's so huge. So there's a chance they can get back to that dragon and save her.
Yeah.
But they don't have enough. We don't have any time. We got to go. We don't have enough money for food. We're just going to have to kill monsters and eat them in the dungeon. That's going to have to be our food. And then there's this like dwarf character that hears them talking about this. And he's like, it's always been my dream to eat monsters. I'm with you. And then it's them trying to fight their way through the dungeon. But it constantly stops for like a cooking show. Like it literally like changes animation style. And it's just about them like delicately preparing all of this food and talking about ways we can cook all these monsters and stuff. So it's a really tongue in cheek, like kind of self-aware that this is a D&D style pulpy thing, but also pivoting into this weird cooking, like the chef's table or something like that, like really high end, delicate care preparation food, but with grotesque, gross monsters. So that's Delicious in Dungeon. And I watched the first two episodes of that. Very fun. So I'll be keeping on with that. So
very cool. So Delicious in Dungeon. And what was the name of the other one, Mike?
It is called Frieren Beyond Journey's End.
Okay. And they're both on Netflix?
No, Frieren is on, I believe, Crunchyroll or Funimation.
Okay.
Or those things are combining now. I don't really know. Sony's trying to pull some bullshit because they own both of them.
So I can rant about that for a little bit.
Yes,
I subscribed to Funimation over a year ago at this point, specifically so just so that I could watch Dragon Ball.
Right.
I've been using it to watch Dragon Ball, and I just found out I went to go watch episode 60 of Dragon Ball Z the other day. And there was a big message that said Funimation is like turning into Crunchyroll, or they're merging. And so theoretically, everything that's on Funimation will be on Crunchyroll. But when that merger happens, Crunchyroll's prices are going way up.
Of course, yeah.
And so now I am currently paying, I think, like $6 a month for Funimation, which is a pretty cheap thing as far as streaming services go.
Yeah.
And I don't know what Crunchyroll's like monthly thing was, but I know its annual thing went from like 60 a year to like 99 a year or something like
that.
Like a huge price increase. And now I'm going to have to pay more money if I want to watch Dragon Ball Z on the service, unless Mike D can somehow figure out a way to get me those episodes in another in another fashion.
Yes, yeah, we're at the point where it is a moral imperative to pirate things now.
Exactly.
So go ahead and do that. But yeah, we'll figure it out. But yeah, I saw that the other day. I was like, wait a second, what is happening with Crunchy? Like, I think it's Sony owns both services now.
Okay.
And so they're just merging them into one and hiking the price up because monopolies are bad.
Yeah, I mean, the merging of them into one kind of makes sense to me just because they're both kind of the same service. They're both just anime, but hiking the price up. No sale, man. Come on.
Yeah, fuck off. What are you, Google?
Yeah, exactly. But all right, so one of them's on Funimation, you said, or Crunchyroll.
I think it's Crunchyroll for Frieren, and then Delicious in Dungeon is on Netflix.
Cool. All right, so those are available places. And then I have a few TV shows, actually, I wanted to talk about, too. First of which, I just finished Poker Face.
Oh.
Which, you know, that aired about a year ago. It was the first season of Poker Face. I believe they're doing a second season. And I think I talked about this show maybe when I first started watching it, but I finally finished it, and man, this show's so good. Mike D, you haven't watched it yet, right?
I have not watched it yet, but I'm very aware of it, you know, as a Rian Johnson stan. So.
Right, and it's extremely your shit. Like, I really feel like you would really, really dig the show, Mike. I think you'd be really into it. So yeah, it's created by Rian Johnson. It stars Natasha Lyonne in the lead role, and she is a woman who is kind of like a drifter who has this innate ability to always know when someone is lying. Like, just no matter what. It's like a weird gift that she has where, like, she can tell if someone is lying. And it turns into basically a murder of the week show. So the first episode kind of establishes the status quo where she is on the run. And then every week she goes into a new town and a new job. She ends up getting involved in some other murder and she's able to kind of like suss out who did it, you know?
So it's like Kung Fu or the Hulk, but with a detective.
Yes. So the thing is, she's not a detective. She's just like a drifter.
Even better.
But she just kind of like gets involved in all these shenanigans. It's basically, it's Rian Johnson and Tasha Leone like doing their version of Columbo.
Right.
But without the person like actually working for the law and just being like kind of somebody on the run from something. And yeah, it's fantastic. Every episode is like its own self-contained like murder mystery. And every episode always starts with like, much like Columbo, like you know who did it right from the beginning. Like it shows you like a long like 15-minute prologue introducing you to all these new characters. And then like you see how the murder happens, who did it. And then Natasha Lyonne comes into town and she has to like figure out, like she has to catch up to the audience essentially. It's great. It's so, so good. It's really, really fun. Every episode's so strong. Every episode also has like a large list of guest stars who are part of it, who pop in for the one episode. So like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's in one, naturally, because it's a Rian Johnson thing. And Nick Nolte is in one and Tim Meadows is in one. And yeah, it's great. Nick Nolte, by the way, playing Phil Tippett, director of Mad God, the stop motion animator. And like his story in the episode is like inspired by Phil Tippett's journey to make Mad God. And I guess he's like a stop motion animator who has been working on his passion project for like 30 years. It's a non-narrative passion project with like weird goopy effects. And Phil Tippett, I guess, got word of it when they were making the episode. And so he sent them a bunch of stuff from Mad God to use in the episode.
Wild.
It's really cool. Really fun. And then, yeah, the finale is great. Like the finale like really ties things together and like, you know, brings it all full circle, but kind of sets up a new thing for potential season two. It's fantastic. It's so good. Mike, I think you would really, really love this show.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why. I think it's like the peacock of it all. And I was just like, yeah, I'll get to it eventually. I'll find it on, you know, by means eventually and watch it. But I've heard great stuff and it sounds exactly like a thing I would love. So maybe once I finish some of these animes, I'll hop over to how could I forget the name of the show?
Poker Face.
All I can think was Peacock now. I was like, that's not it. That's the streaming service.
Poker Face. It's 10 episodes. I think Rian Johnson directed the first episode and the ninth episode and also wrote like episode 2 and 10 or something like that. But the episodes that he's not involved with are also great. You know, it's really terrific. So yeah, high recommend on Poker Face. And then also wanted to give a quick shout out to Clone High, which is back once again for its now third season. Although if you go to HBO Max, it'll say second season because it's the second season of The Revival.
Right.
When the first season of The Revival was coming out last year, it really felt like, oh man, they're putting a lot behind this. Like there's been a lot of hype for it. There was a trailer. People were into it. And this time around, it really feels like they just kind of dumped this show.
You can feel the Zaslav.
Yeah, exactly. There was no trailer for this new season. They put all the episodes out at once instead of weekly and all that stuff. So I'm a little worried about the future of Clone High. But I will say I've watched about half of the season so far. It's fantastic. It's so good. I think season two was like, I really enjoyed it, but it definitely like maybe wasn't up to the par of the first season of Clone High. The original one season show. And this current season, I think has like reached like a level of consistency where I'm like, oh man, they're like batting 100. This is great. I'm really invested in all the like insane relationship drama that the show does, but also the insane wild Looney Tunes stuff. There's a great callback to season one where they bring back a character that I was so delighted to see. And yeah, really enjoyed it. So I'm halfway through this new season of Clone High. It's great. And if you haven't watched Clone High, check it out. It's great. I think off of my recommendation, you maybe watch like two episodes of the original run, Mike.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I watched the first couple episodes or so, and I don't really know why I didn't keep watching them. I really liked it. It was fun. But I think it's another one of those, like, well, I mean, I guess I need to reevaluate this stance because I'm like, well, it'll be there. Right. That's not a given anymore. So who knows when something will just be deleted from existence.
Yeah. Yeah. That is my worry with this new Clone High for sure. So we'll see what happens, but it's on HBO Max right now if people want to check it out. That's the TV stuff I wanted to mention. And then also I've been watching a ton of Buster Keaton movies, Mike.
Oh,
yeah. So as you know, I am about 8 or 9 months behind on every podcast that I listen to, right?
Yes, correct.
You know, that's just a factor of me not having to commute to work. You know, it's I walk and, you know, I try to catch up when I can, but it's tougher to, when I was in New York, man, I would fly through podcasts. It was great. Second I moved to Missoula, I immediately created like a backlog of podcasts. So I have like 9 months of a backlog, and I just got to the Blank Check miniseries on Buster Keaton, which happened in like May of last year. And listening to the first episode, I was like, you know what? I've only seen one actual Buster Keaton feature, which was The General.
Right.
And so I'm like, you know what? All these movies are about an hour long, which makes them fairly like quick to watch. And they're all available on YouTube because of the public domain. They're all public domain. Like they're all out there in existence. So I decided to try to watch as many of these Buster Keaton movies as I can to catch up with the podcast before I get to the episodes. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, I've now watched 6 Buster Keaton movies.
Nice.
In the last like, couple of weeks. I watched 3 Ages, Our Hospitality, Sherlock Jr., The Navigator, 7 Chances, and Go West. And of those 6, Sherlock Jr., I mean, that's the consensus choice for like among the best Buster Keaton movies. It's great, man. It's so good. Also the shortest one. It's 45 minutes long.
Nice.
And it's just a really like masterful filmmaking thing. But also just I really enjoyed all 6 of these movies. It's a lot of really fun stuff. I think Sherlock Jr. and 7 Chances were probably the best ones. 7 Chances features this insane like rock slide sequence in the last 20 minutes. And then Our Hospitality is also one I really enjoyed, which is the one that's like sort of based on the Hatfields and McCoys feud and all that stuff. But it's fun to like watch them and be like, oh, he's actually like parodying things of the time. Like
right.
Three Ages is his first movie, and it's sort of a parody of D.W. Griffith's Intolerance.
Wow.
Which is one of those things that like, oh, most audiences, like, you know, watching it now, you're like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
But back then, that must have been like very groundbreaking and stuff. But yeah, there's so many funny gags, so many insane stunts. Yeah, it's really like wild to watch some of the stuff and be like, wow, I can't believe he didn't die from that. And then there's stuff that I'm still like, you know, a movie that's like 100 years old with Sherlock Jr. And I'm like, man, how did he do that? Like, how did he do those things? There's a moment in Sherlock Jr. where he jumps into a guy's chest and like shows and appears on like the wall, like on the other side of the wall behind him.
Yep.
And there's no like real like noticeable cut there. There's no like moment where you're like, oh, well, I can see where they edited it, splice something in. He just like dives into a guy's chest. I'm like, how did he do that?
Yeah, I think I've seen the behind the scenes thing on that one. It's crazy.
Yeah,
but Keaton is one of those guys I've definitely identified more as like a Chaplin head than a Keaton guy for a long time. And then you see some of them and you're like, oh, wait a second. not that they're like, there has to be a dichotomy or anything there, but it's just one of those things that like, oh yeah, Chaplin's the first one, I guess, most people are exposed to. And then the more you get into it, and it's fascinating to watch those movies. And I don't think I've seen many of the Keaton feature length ones, air quotes, whatever that, you know, definition
right.
is, a 45 minute thing. But I remember a class in college, and it wasn't a film class. I think it was an English class for some reason. We watched a bunch of Keaton's shorts and I was like, whoa, this is a bit like a whole new, you know, broaden your horizons kind of thing. So that's very exciting.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're all for free available to all of us. So go watch them, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I also was like, I'm more of a Chaplin guy. And I think Chaplin's a better like introduction to silent film, I guess.
I think
like,
so,
Like it maybe feels a little bit more modern and like that it goes for bigger laughs, because I think a lot of Buster Keaton stuff is funny, but it's also like it's also aiming to tell like a fairly dramatic story a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so I think Chaplin is more just like absurdist in that way. But plus, like, I think modern times it's like a sort of blend of silent film and sound.
There's sound.
So you can kind of like ease your way into silent film with that movie, which that movie's masterpiece. But yeah. They're both great. Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, both good stuff. Go watch them.
Watch them. Check them out.
Yeah. All right, Mike D, what else have you been watching?
I've also been watching, I watched Meek's Cutoff, directed by Kelly Reichardt.
Okay.
Which I think this is one of those first Reichardts for me. I've talked about it, danced around a lot of her movies and stuff for a while, and just like haven't finally pushed play on some of them. So yeah, Meek's Cutoff. This is a story. It's basically the Oregon Trail. I think it's like loosely based on a real event or something like that, where this guy is a navigator, something Meek, I forget his first name, but he's got this shortcut that he's going to lead this wagon train on their way out west. And it turns out he's wrong, basically. He leads them away from water into a desert just as they get more and more desperate, as they get more and more lost. Like it literally opens with a guy carving the word lost into a dead tree stump. So like if
right.
anyone comes behind them, they'll know kind of thing. And you're just like, holy shit. And yeah, it stars Michelle Williams. Bruce Greenwood is Meek. which is great. Will Patton, Zoe Kazan, and Paul Dano, which is funny. It was like, oh, Zoe Kazan is then in the Buster Scruggs, the girl who, whatever.
Right. Which is the girl who got rattled.
Who got rattled, yeah, which is like the same story, I think.
Yeah, very, very similar. And then Zoe Kazan and Paul Dano got married, I think, in real life.
Yeah,
right?
I think they're a couple now, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's just fascinating, and I think the slow cinema aspect of it, you know, it's really just these people walking for a long time, really adds to the tension and the desperation. You really feel that, whereas just you really get to sit in how harrowing and awful this experience would be, where they're just there's nothing for in any direction, you don't know, and you're like, we're just gonna walk and hope we're going in the right way, and you just get to sit with that and feel that for them. The only thing, my only like complaint maybe that stops this from being like an incredible movie to me is that I wish it gets to more of a fever pitch towards the end, where like things start to go wrong or get worse. Rather, they're already gone wrong when the movie starts, but you know, things start to get worse. But I guess it sort of makes sense. It gets worse to a realistic degree. Like it never goes over that like level where it's like, I don't even know how to describe what I'm talking about, but you know what I mean? I think
it doesn't turn into like ravenous. Like.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't turn into like some crazy shit. It just turns into, well, this is just the reality of the situation. And that alone is horrifying. But,
right.
And then they also find an indigenous person and they're like trying to, they think he's leading them to water, but they're not sure. Cause obviously they don't speak the same language. So they don't know what's going on. And the reversal of the movie beginning with all the men being the only ones that make all the decisions. And they like walk away from the women to have these discussions and come back and be like, this is what we're doing, and then have that slowly erode and get further and further in the direction that now Michelle Williams' character is the one making decisions by the end, right? That like they all turn and look to her in like the final shot, which is fascinating. But yeah, I don't know. Meek's cut off. It was really good. I mean, it's intense. It's scary. And so, yeah, I'm ready to maybe get into the Reichardt mode some more.
Nice. Yeah. This was actually also my first Kelly Reichardt movie.
Oh, really?
I saw it in theaters. That was back in 2010 when this came out. And I saw it at the Upstate Films in Rhinebeck. And I went with my buddy who really did not like the movie.
Amazing.
But I really enjoyed it and thought it was really interesting. And like, it was one of my first like kind of slow cinema sort of movies, something that I got really into. And I remember very specifically it was a packed theater. Like it was like really crowded in there. And I remember the theater employee like running up to the front before the movie started and be like, "Hey everyone, we're starting Meek's Cut Off. Just so you know, this movie is shot in a 4:3 aspect ratio."
Yes.
So please don't complain about it. That was a deliberate choice by the filmmaker. That's not a, this is like,
yeah, I, even when the movie started, for me, that's very funny. Like I of course found it through Beans. So it starts and I'm like, okay, pause, Google, Meek's Cut Off 4:3 ? Cause you never know when you download a thing, whether it's accurate or not. So yes, it is in 4:3, but the decision to do that was wild. I saw, I guess an interview or whatever in my Google search from Kelly Reichardt that it was, they decided to do that because that's the point of view of a woman wearing a bonnet. You know, it cuts off all your peripheral vision. And I was like, holy shit, that's wild. Because you would expect a movie like this to be in big widescreen, you know, the huge vistas, giant horizons. But like, no, Michelle Williams' character can only see this. And it's the 4:3, you know, type of vision. And I was like, wow. Fascinating.
Nice.
Cinema. Hashtag cinema.
There you go. Yes. So that, I remember that experience being very funny. But really loving the movie and my friend really hating it. And then for some reason, like recommending it to my family because I had talked about it.
Yeah.
And so my dad like got it from the Netflix disc plan and they watched it while I was like, I think I was maybe away at college or something. And like I wasn't home when they watched it and I got back home and they're like, yeah, that movie sucked. Like that was it was not a good family movie. Experience.
Whoops.
So yeah. Oh well. But I really like Meek's Cut Off. I would like to rewatch it. I haven't seen it since then. And I am in general a fan of Kelly Reichardt. But if you like that, Certain Women, Mike, really good. High recommend the breakout performance of Lily Gladstone from right here at the Roxy.
That's right. Yeah. I was also thinking, is it Wendy and Lucy? I think.
Wendy and Lucy, which I think is the movie she made right before Meek's Cut Off.
Oh, okay.
So that was because she's worked with Michelle Williams a bunch. Like that's like her most frequent collaborator,
right.
For sure. And she was just recently in Showing Up, which is also very good.
All right.
Worth checking out. But all right, Meek's Cut Off. One of Mike D's picks. I have a couple of recent releases to talk about, Mike. A couple of new movies.
New movies from the theater?
Yes. And actually, speaking of moments where I have to tell the audience that this thing is supposed to be like this.
Yeah.
The Zone of Interest, which, speaking of slow cinema, this is the new film from Jonathan Glazer, which we are playing right now at the Roxy, the Indie Theater near my house in Missoula, Montana, where I also work. And yeah, Jonathan Glazer, director of Sexy Beast, Birth, and Under the Skin. He has not made a movie since Under the Skin, so it's been about 10 years since there's been a new Jonathan Glazer film. And right now on the Criterion channel, there's a few Jonathan Glazer movies up there. There's a collection. I believe Birth and Sexy Beast are both there, plus a couple of shorts, right?
Yes, as far as I'm aware, yeah.
Nice. So The Zone of Interest is a Holocaust movie. It is about Auschwitz, but it's a Holocaust movie unlike anything I've ever seen. It is a Holocaust movie that is about the commanding officer at Auschwitz and his family who live right next to Auschwitz. They are like live in this like kind of like pretty idyllic like home with like beautiful gardens and like it's a large house and they have parties there all the time and stuff. But they are sharing a wall with Auschwitz,
right?
And so it's a movie where you're just watching this family and really like the mother and the father. The mother played by Sandra Hüller from Anatomy of a Fall as well, having just a wild year.
Big year.
Yeah, exactly. And you're just watching them live their lives in mostly like peaceful, idyllic situations while like atrocities are happening just right next door, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, shots where you're just watching the family like, you know, play in the pool, and like in the background you can see all the towers from Auschwitz, or you can see smoke coming out of like all that kind of stuff. And
yeah,
I wasn't sure if I was liking the movie for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, because you are just watching that for a long time, and you know, as the movie goes on, it's really interesting to watch these people you know, completely turn a blind eye to the horrific things that are happening right next to them just so that they could advance further in their own lives. But it is like it's a can't look away kind of situation, I think. Like you're kind of just like stuck there, stuck watching them. And I wasn't sure if I was digging it for a while. I was definitely engaged with it. But then the last like 10 minutes of the movie happened, and they really hit me hard. They are very difficult, very profound. And yeah, it's a movie that is largely about the mundanity of tragedy. Like, you know, something that like, you know, tragic events, horrific things that are like awful for so many people. But like to certain other subsets of people, it's just like, oh, this is a mundane part of my life that I'm dealing with. It's really fascinating. It's horrifying. It's very, very good. It's a movie I've been thinking about a lot. But I will say the movie starts with, I think, 3 minutes of a black screen with just audio.
Wow.
And so much like Meek's Cutoff, there have been many complaints from the audience of people thinking our screen is broken.
That makes sense.
And so we've had to like put up a sign being like, no, The Zone of Interest is supposed to be like that.
Right.
Just go back inside. Because it is meant to be like kind of lull you into like the sort of movie soundscape that it's kind of creating. But yeah, it's fascinating. It's worth checking out. It's a movie that is very difficult. I'm not sure it's one I'll ever watch again. But yeah, it's absolutely worth watching. And it's really fascinating to me that it ended up getting the acclaim that it did as far as the Academy goes. It feels like a very like, I mean, you know, the Academy drawn to Holocaust movies, that's not a big surprise. But this is a very difficult movie and like a very esoteric one and very different from everything else that's nominated. And again, then ended up getting Best Picture and Best Director and Best International Film. And like, it's nominated for a bunch of stuff. And it was the last of the Best Picture nominees that I had to watch. So I have now seen it.
Very nice. Yeah, this is a movie that I've been very interested in because I remember seeing the poster or something on, like, it's like sort of treated as a reveal sort of in the marketing and stuff that like what this movie is about.
Yeah.
And the poster is like them in the garden, the family in the garden with the big wall, and then the like above the wall where you would see what they're next to is all blacked out, like the whole thing, if you've seen the poster, I'm sure.
Yes.
So I like had no idea what it was about, and I just saw like stuff online a couple, you know, when it was first in its limited release and stuff. And then I talking about like, wow, like one of those harrowing movies, like, you know, you must see kind of thing, like to deal with our modern times kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I saw the trailer for it and I was like, holy shit, this is what this movie is about. Like totally blown away. Like, this is what they're doing. And then hearing all the behind the scenes stuff that like they sort of just mic'd up and set up cameras all over that house and didn't like have a script or didn't like tell them what was going to be in the movie, what's not in the movie, all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it seems very fascinating and it's been very divisive, which is, I guess, makes sense. But it was just on an episode of The Movies That Made Me. They had Dan Waters on, which is Joe Dante's podcast. Dan Waters wrote Heathers and stuff like that.
Okay, yeah.
and he's just friends with them. And I guess every year he's like a Mike Smith type of person that ranks and categorizes every single movie that he sees within a year, knows sure. he saw like over 300 movies and he's all this stuff. So they had him just to do a 2023, what are some of the stuff you want to highlight? And they ended up talking about Zone of Interest. And they all, Josh Rolson, Joe Dante, and Dan Waters all had a similar reaction to it, that they felt that it makes its point in like the first 20 or 30 minutes and it's really impactful and is amazing. But then it's just that for another hour and a half or so. And they were kind of like, I get it, but like, you gotta elevate, you gotta do something else. Which seems very interesting. Like, that's also an interesting reaction to it. So
yeah, I think that's sort of maybe where I'm at actually with it too. Yeah. It absolutely makes its point. I get it. Yeah. It's just a very difficult movie.
Yeah. You know,
that's the thing,
which is fine. I mean, Hey, that's movies. So I do want to see it eventually, but I'll just jump in here to speaking of Jonathan Glazer, and that Criterion Collection, Criterion Channel collection of his movies and a few shorts. I did watch Sexy Beast, which, is a movie I had heard about a lot, or had seen at least like images from, because it's a very, very visual movie, has like very striking images. And this movie's fucking incredible. I had a total blast with it, and it's wild to see that this is Jonathan Glazer's first movie, is like this. And he's only made, like, what was it, three or four movies?
He's made four feature films. It's Sexy Beast, Birth, Under the Skin, and Zone of Interest. So I have not seen Sexy Beast or Birth. I plan to watch Sexy Beast pretty soon, and I'm holding off on Birth to see if Nicole Kidman wins the poll or not.
Right. So yeah, I mean, and I think I've also heard the stuff with Under the Skin. It also has like pseudo documentary, like hidden camera, didn't tell people they were being in a movie kind of thing with Scarlett Johansson.
An aspect of it, yeah.
Yeah, for certain parts of it. So, but Sexy Beast is so stylized. It is so like not those things at all. So it's wild to see that within the span of two movies. You know, I mean, I don't know anything about Birth, but he goes to Under the Skin and has that kind of stuff. And then also, like we said, with Zone of Interest, just kind of mics the house. But Sexy Beast is about Roy Winstone is a retired criminal gangster person. They don't really explain other than that. Like he's survived the one last job, you know, which happened before the movie. Like it's been 10 years. He's in Spain living in his villa, just outside by the pool tanning in his like little banana hammock Speedo. And it's like so funny and amazing. It's just about that life for the first 10, 20 minutes or so. And then enrolls an old partner, an old person played by Ben Kingsley, who comes in and offers him one last job. It's like, you know, you're never really out kind of situation. And Ben Kingsley is terrifying. He is just so unhinged and so psychotic and one of those kind of people. And this movie, like I said, is so stylized. It's doing smash cuts or match cuts or whatever, just in the space of a single conversation, we'll just jump time to now it's nighttime. You're just like, what the fuck is going on? And they're still talking. They're still having the same conversation. So it's very wild like that. There's one sequence in particular where Ben Kingsley is trying to convince Ray Winstone to accept this job, and he's telling him the story of how he got the job, like how Ben Kingsley got involved. And it's like it's him relaying the story, and then it's cutting to the story, like you're seeing the story as Ben Kingsley's relaying it, which is him being relayed a story. And so like it goes like three or four layers deep, and it's cutting back and forth between all of them. Like, just, it's amazing. It's beautiful. And then Ian McShane is also in this. He's like the guy in England that is putting together this job. So like he's in it, but not in a ton, but he's in it there. And then it's like becomes like a heist thing, and it's like the one last job situation. And it's just amazing. It's great. Everyone is just on 1,000 in the movie. Ray Winstone's amazing in it too. And super, super stylish and visual and colors, because it's like the Spanish villa and stuff. And I don't know. It's really great. It's amazing. So check out Sexy Beast. I had a lot of fun with it. So it's wild to see. That's his first movie, and then Zone of Interest. Like, to put those two next to each other is a very fascinating thing.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch Sexy Beast and Birth just so I can kind of track the evolution a little bit more, because Zone of Interest makes sense when you've only seen Under the Skin. Like, Under the Skin is like, it's a pretty slow, methodical movie, and like, it's like, okay, I can extrapolate from there how you get to Zone of Interest. But Sexy Beast sounds like a blast. Like, it sounds really fun.
Yeah, it's like it's got like a not quite an Edgar Wright editing vibe type situation, but it's like in that realm.
Okay.
You know, so like really kinetic stuff, which is bananas when you think about Zone of Interest.
Nice. I do know. So Jonathan Glazer also like used to be a music video director. He used to direct
that makes a lot more sense, actually. Yeah.
I like directed a few Radiohead videos and stuff. And I saw there was an interesting stat. That was just a funny tweet, really, from Emily Vanderwerf, who said that, Jonathan Glazer was nominated for Best Director at the MTV Video Music Awards twice, but didn't win. Mm-hmm. Was nominated twice at the VMAs for Best Director, but did win an award for special effects for a music video he did at the VMAs.
Okay.
Which makes him the Stanley Kubrick of the MTV Video Music Awards. Because Stanley Kubrick never won, was nominated but never won Best Director, but did win a special effects Oscar for 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Fascinating.
Which I thought was really interesting. So yeah, of music videos, Jonathan Glazer, he is the Stanley Kubrick. And yeah, Zone of Interest, very good. Sexy Beast, sounds like it's very good. So worth checking out.
Yeah, and you can see too, just like you can see the like visual flair and a lot of stuff in Sexy Beast, just like in blocking. Like just having people standing outside around a pool and just like where they're all standing in position. It's just like yeah. Whoa. A lot of frames that were just like, whoa, this is cool as hell. Like just looks super stylish. which is bananas. So that's Sexy Beast.
What else have you been watching, Mike?
I have also watched a new documentary that just hit Netflix, which is called The Greatest Night in Pop. And this is a documentary about the making and recording of the We Are the World benefit song, which is really fascinating. It had, you know, everybody, I've obviously heard the song and like seen the video and like a passing pop cultural knowledge of this event.
Sure, yeah.
It was in 1985 where they recorded this song to raise money and awareness for a famine in Ethiopia at the time. And this documentary is just really a like kind of step-by-step process on how they recorded this, which is insane that I guess I never was aware of this. It was literally recorded in a single night after an award show that everybody was at because they were trying to coordinate right. everybody's schedules and they realized like, oh shit, everybody's going to be in LA on the night of the American Music Awards. And it's the only time all these people are all going to be in the same city at the same time. It has to be that night. So they, yeah. and the crazy thing is they're also filming the music video while they were recording it. So,
right.
So they had cameras in the room recording the entire thing because they were trying to make a music video too. So there is just raw footage of them trying to record this song. And how do you coordinate 45 of the, I think, or 44 or something like that, of the largest names in pop music at the time, like Paul Simon and Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles and Huey Lewis and Sheila E. and Bette Midler is there, which is crazy. Dan Aykroyd is in there, which is nuts. And that's the one thing I wish
one of the biggest names in pop music.
I wish they explained how or why. I mean, I guess he's a blues brother and stuff, but it's just like he's standing sure. next to Harry Belafonte and I forget who's on the other side of him. But it's just like what's going through Dan Aykroyd's mind, you know? and then it's also has a lot, so it's got a lot of talking head interviews with Bruce Springsteen and Huey Lewis and Kenny Loggins and Lionel Richie is sort of like the main guy because I guess he sort of coordinated and spearheaded all this
right
and wrote the song with Michael Jackson and there's a really funny section talking about Lionel and Michael Jackson. We're like, oh, we're gonna have a couple months, like who knows when this is gonna ever happen. What, you know, they're kind of messing around and like kind of just fumbling, and then all of a sudden they get the call from Quincy Jones, who's producing the whole thing, that it's happening in 3 weeks, the night of the American Music Awards, which Lionel Richie is hosting. So he hosted a whole award show and then comes to the studio and does this thing. And Bob Dylan also is involved. So yeah, it's really a really just kind of fly on the wall look into the 12 hours or whatever it was that took them to record this song over the course of a single night, because that's the only time everybody was going to be there. So if you're into that, it seems like a sort of like, I've never seen that Get Back documentary, the Beatles.
Oh, the Beatles doc, yeah.
But from what I've heard, it has a similar vibe to that because it is just fly on the wall in the room while it's happening kind of situation. So yeah, I had a fun time with it, and it's interesting, and it's cool to see all these people be terrified of having to sing while like Huey Lewis has a very funny thing about like Prince was supposed to come, but of course he's Prince, so he's like, I'm only coming if I can do a guitar solo, and they're like, okay, no. So they have to give his line, they give it to Huey Lewis, who was just supposed to be in the big chorus section, and now he's got a solo line that he has to sing after Michael Jackson, like he's next in line after Michael Jackson, and he's like, what am I doing here? And it's very, very fun. So yeah, check out Greatest Night in Pop. It's a good time.
Nice. I like the idea of the after party at this award show just being completely empty because everybody is stuck doing
they doing said the song. They had to like, basically it was also this one guy, I forget his name, was the manager of, was Lionel Rich's manager. And so they like went to everybody that he managed first, you know, to get to be involved right. in the song. So like it was talking about him having to, as soon as the award show ended, like wrangle 20 people, be like, no, you have to leave now. You have to go to this short award. Like you have to go to this recording studio and you can't hang out here. You have to leave.
Right.
Very, very fun.
Nice. All right. So that's The Greatest Night in Pop, which I think it's on Netflix, right? It's like a Netflix yes. documentary.
Yeah. I know there was actually, I heard they talked about this on Filmcast podcast about this was like a Sundance premiere at the like live or the like in-person section of it.
Okay. Yeah.
And there was like some consternation about this already having distribution and it is on Netflix a week later. They were like pissed that like they basically used Sundance as like just a promotional thing.
Right.
You know, it's like as opposed to the indie movies that are trying to get bought and all this stuff. And I don't know, interesting film stuff.
Yeah, there you go. But all right, it's on Netflix right now. Check it out. And then I have another new release that I wanted to talk about as well, which is The Beekeeper. Which,
son of a bitch.
So as soon as I saw the trailer for The Beekeeper, I was like, well, I have to go see The Beekeeper. And this is a new January Jason Statham action movie directed by David Ayer, director of End of Watch and the 2016 Suicide Squad, Bright.
Fury?
And Fury, yeah.
I heard that's the good one.
Yeah, I've never seen Fury, to be fair. But of the David Ayer movies I've seen, I have not previously liked any of them. That said, Beekeeper fucking rocks. This is the kind of thing he should be making.
Okay.
So The Beekeeper is essentially Jason Statham doing his own, it's become overdone to say like, oh, they're doing their own John Wick. Mm. This is like very obviously like just trying like him doing John Wick. It's very much that on a much like dumber and goofier scale than John Wick does. So I'm going to spoil parts of The Beekeeper because some of it's so insane I have to talk about it.
Okay.
Is that okay, Mike?
Sure. You know, I don't know if the plot of The Beekeeper is really what we're there for.
All right. So Jason Statham stars in The Beekeeper as a beekeeper. Are you with me so far?
I'm following. Go on.
Okay. So he is a beekeeper that tends to the bees and like also like is like kind of the gardener for this woman played by Felicia Rashad. And, you know, he's like a solitary guy. He lives a peaceful life. It sort of feels like the beginning of Master Gardener. a little bit. And Felicia Rashad is like this very wealthy woman who lives in this farm, pretty much alone. Her kids are out of the house, all that kind of stuff. But she's kind of grown a connection with this beekeeper, Jason Statham, who has been tending her house. And so she invites him to dinner. He goes to, you know, get some honey from his bees to bring over to dinner. And while he's gone, she gets a phone or she's on her laptop and she gets a pop-up that says like, oh, you have a virus. Call this number. And she calls that number and it's a scammer. It's like and it's like this huge building with like 50 or 60 people in this room who are like all trying to scam people all at once. Right. And it's like this big, like almost like a price. Like the guy's treating it like a game show. Like how can we scam all these people out of their money and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, he's basically like this virus is a scam for this old woman. He is taking advantage of her. He ends up wiping out all of her money. And she has like millions of dollars in a charity that she had like invested in or whatever.
Wow.
And he like takes millions of dollars away from her. She's left with nothing. And when she realizes what happened, she kills herself.
Okay. okay.
And so Jason Statham has to go get revenge and take out these these crypto bros and these scammers who are taking advantage of these defenseless old ladies who are killing themselves after losing their money. And it's the best. It's 90 minutes of Jason Statham just like beating down crypto bros for a very long time, which is a very good time.
That sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah. Josh Hutcherson is the main bad guy. Also, Jeremy Irons is in it.
What?
As like the handler for Josh Hutcherson. Because here's the twist. I'm going to give you the twist at what happens in The Beekeeper. I don't want to in case you watch the movie because it was such a surprise to me.
Okay. But go on. I'm not going to watch this.
I got to talk about it. You should watch it, Mike. I got to talk about it. So spoilers for The Beekeeper right here. But it turns out that Josh Hutcherson, like you don't know this until about 45 minutes, 50 minutes into the movie. Josh Hutcherson, who is in charge of this whole scamming operation, he is the son of the president of the United States.
It goes all the way to the top.
It goes all the way to the top. And in fact, he used the illegal funds that he took from scamming people to fund his mom's presidency.
Oh, my God.
It's such an insane thing. And so the end of the movie is Jason Statham like infiltrating not the White House, but like a sort of, you know, offshore house that they're all staying at or whatever. And he like just beating up dudes left and right as he's making his way to the president and her son. And it's wild. It's such a good time. And then also all the action sequences are really fun. It's really fun action all the way through. So yeah, it's great. I really enjoyed The Beekeeper and I highly recommend you check it out, Mike.
Okay. All right. So that was going to be my question is like what kind kind of like, you know, it's the sort of John Wick movie type thing. Like, I doubt it has that like direct style of action, but it's above like a Taken, where it's like a thousand cuts, you know, kind of thing.
Above a Taken, under a John Wick. But also it's like, I didn't even mention this, but he's a beekeeper, right? Mm-hmm. But that's actually his cover, because he's actually part of a secret organization called the Beekeepers.
Oh, it's so obvious you'd never notice it.
Yeah, which is like basically he is like, you know, a super secret agent. Most of the government doesn't even know about him, but he was like bred to be an assassin. And like, you know, I'm not even sure exactly what the Beekeepers do.
Some Jason Bourne shit.
Basically, yeah. And so he's like an ex beekeeper. And so the people from the his old life are sending a beekeeper after him to try to get him and stuff. Yeah. And there's one guy who shows up. It's like, I killed a beekeeper once and I can do it again. And he's like got a medal leg from when he tried to kill the beekeeper the last time.
Amazing.
It's great. It's a good time. And Jason Statham locked in a way that like, he hasn't been in a few years. Like it's been a while since we've had like, I think, a proper Jason Statham action movie, you know?
Yeah. No Hobbs and Shaw bullshit.
Exactly. Yeah. It's been a lot of the Hobbs and Shaws or the Megs or that kind of thing. And, you know, I mean, I guess there was, I never saw Operation Fortune last year, the Guy Ritchie movie, but it's fun to just have this out here. Like just a solid Jason Statham action movie released in January. Like it's exactly what I want.
Nice.
So yeah, it did the job. The Beekeeper. Well worth checking out.
All right. Good for you, Mike.
Yeah, you should watch it, Mike. I think you would enjoy it.
When it hits VOD, when it's at home, you know, I'll just have a blast watching it.
There's a chance that I got tickets to go see Dune 2 at an IMAX showing with a few friends, and I think afterwards we might go back to their house and watch The Beekeeper.
As is custom.
It has been discussed. But yeah, so that's The Beekeeper, and then one other action movie I wanted to mention. This past weekend was this month's Inferno of Danger at the Roxy Theater, which I host, the indie theater near my house, Missoula, Montana, where I also work, and I host Inferno of Danger, and I showed The Last Dragon from 1985, which I had never seen before, and had a great time with. It's really fun. Are you familiar with The Last Dragon at all, Mike?
I am not, actually. I don't think I know the plot of this movie, or I don't think I've heard of it.
Okay, so The Last Dragon is a movie from 1985 produced by Berry Gordy.
the Motown guy?
Yes. It's actually called Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
Incredible.
And it is half blaxploitation action movie, half Motown music video. And yeah, so it stars Timac as this guy, Bruce Leroy, who is who is heavily influenced by Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
And he is a guy who is he has completed his training, or at least he's completed this phase of his training, and he's trying to find a new master to take him to the next level so he can achieve the glow, which is like, you know, enlightenment or whatever, like mm-hmm. The best possible thing he can possibly get. And so it takes place in New York City, it takes place in Harlem, and he is just trying to find a new master. Meanwhile, there is this this other guy, the Shogun of Harlem, named Shonuff, who is
10 out of 10, honestly.
Yeah, who is terrorizing him at every turn. And all of that's happening while this like MTV VJ played by Vanity from Prince's band is like falling in love with Timac and falling in love with Bruce Leroy. And they get involved with like, there's this record producer who's trying to get his girlfriend's video on the show and she's not letting him on. And so he hires Shonuff to attack her and kidnap her and stuff. It's a wild movie. And every once in a while it stops to be a music video. This is where DeBarge's song Rhythm of the Night comes from.
I know that song.
Yeah. So that was a pretty fun discovery too. And yeah, the action itself, like for the most part, not great, but the last like 20 or 30 minutes really make up for it because it just goes all out. It's really fun. And I got to see it in a crowd full of people, like 70 people who were all very into it. And like, it got applause at the end and like people were cheering when he finally gets the glow and all that, which is great. Also, I got to experience an entire crowd all like simultaneously go at once. Like, wait, is that William H. Macy?
Wait, what?
William H. Macy pops up in a very brief role early on in the movie.
Amazing.
And it's like 1985, so it's like he looks young and it's weird.
Does he have a mustache still?
No mustache.
Fascinating.
Yeah, very strange. But yeah, really enjoyed The Last Dragon. It's worth checking out, Mike. It's a good time.
That's awesome. Yeah, it sounds fun. I'm glad it seems to have really taken inspiration from the just absolutely incomprehensible plots of all the Hong Kong action movies.
Yes.
It just really... steeped in that legacy. Yeah, that sounds wild. I'm thinking now about like Greatest Night in Pop and like all those Motown people. Smokey Robinson also is there. Like all,
oh yeah,
and then also The Last Dragon. Like,
yep,
all those people crossing over is fascinating.
And then that would have been like We Are the World was 1985, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, Last Dragon was 85. It would have been happening at the same time.
That's bananas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was DeBarge. I'm looking at the other performers here. DeBarge. Oh, Smokey Robinson has a song on there.
Amazing.
First time on a Ferris wheel. There's also The Temptations. You got Rockwell, a couple other ones. But yeah, and Vanity. So
does it have like musical numbers in the movie? Like it stops to do musical numbers and stuff?
Yeah.
That's rules.
I mean, it's less like, it's not like, like it's all part of this like larger like, you know, MTV VJ show.
Got it. Okay.
Right. So it's not like the movie itself is like stopping for them to like actually sing or whatever. Yeah. But like, but it sort of is. Anytime they do, anytime they do that.
But it's like musicians in the movie are like, it's
yeah, or you're watching people like make a music video.
Got it. Okay. It's not like a musical. Like it right. stops and we're singing about the action of the movie.
Exactly. It stops very just short of being a full on musical.
Got it.
Okay. But it's like half action movie, half music video.
Awesome.
And yeah, it's a good time. So yeah, worth watching. The Last Dragon. And then yeah, what else? You got one more movie on your list, right, Mike?
Yeah, one more movie is just a rewatch, which is Whiplash.
Yeah,
my friends and I that I'm always talking about in the Discord, hanging out, watching movies. We've started a spreadsheet, as one seems to always do.
Sure.
And so we've got a tab tracking what movies we watched and who was there. And then we've got a tab for requests for movies, you know, what we want to watch together. And somebody put on Whiplash and we were just like, oh, we're here now. So let's just watch Whiplash, you know, because yeah. So we try to say like who requested it. And if that person's not there, we don't watch it without them kind of thing. We've got rules. You understand.
Without rules, there's chaos.
There's chaos. We live in a society. So yeah, we watched Whiplash. I was the only one that had seen it out of the group that was watching it. And a couple of them are musicians or were band kids and like had similar, one person in particular like had an experience similar to the movie what's happening in the movie. Not quite as like emotionally terroristic as J.K. Simmons is in the movie, but that sure. kind of thing. So we were just, he was having a blast like, holy shit, he did that. Or like, wow, this is so close, you know, kind of stuff, which is wild. So yeah, we had a blast watching Whiplash and that movie rules, you know? I don't know about the like recent cultural backlash to Damien Chazelle, particularly Babylon and all that and La La Land. But I mean, what was the First Man? That movie, right?
First Man is also Chazelle. I have liked, I'm going to state my claim, I like every Damien Chazelle movie. I think Babylon is his worst, but there's still a lot of really good stuff in there. It's,
yeah.
You know, it's perhaps a bit self-indulgent at 3 hours and 10 minutes or whatever. But I think there's a lot of really good stuff in there. It kind of like wears out its welcome a little bit.
You know? I haven't seen Babylon yet, but
I think it is sort of worth watching. There's interesting stuff. There's some really great moments, I think, especially in the first half.
Okay.
And then there's a moment where about like 2 hours and 30 minutes into the movie, Tobey Maguire shows up and he leads the protagonist into like a descent into hell.
Hell yeah.
Which is just like, you know, the seedy underbelly of Los Angeles.
Right.
And I was so like tickled by the fact that they were doing it. I'm not sure if it works, but it was just so bananas that I was like sort of on board.
Okay, fair enough.
So yeah, it's worth watching.
Yeah, I'll probably check it out at some point. I haven't seen First Man either, but I know
First Man's very good.
It's supposed to be very good. Yeah, but yeah, Whiplash rules. I love that movie a lot, and even all of its pretentious, you know, stuff. I don't know. I like it a lot. It's fun.
No, I like Whiplash a lot too. I haven't seen it since theaters, but yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I also really love La La Land. I feel like that's the one that I feel like the most embarrassed about sometimes.
Yeah, like, I feel like one really soured a lot of people, and then of course the whole Oscar thing where the
one. Yeah, it almost won and then didn't and all that stuff. But I think that year, I think I did name La La Land my number one movie of the year.
You might have. I don't remember.
I think I did. I think since then, it's kind of gone back and forth between that and The Nice Guys, which came out the same year. Really just a banner year for Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Every year is a good year for Ryan Gosling, but that was a particularly good year.
In particular, yeah.
I think La La Land is still great. I haven't rewatched that since theaters either, but I did watch the first like 20 minutes on a plane like a few months ago, and that first 20 minutes, man, holds up. I'm still pretty into it.
All right, good.
But yeah, nice. So Whiplash, if you haven't seen Whiplash in a while, go watch it. It's very good.
Check it out.
And then I got three more movies I wanted to talk about. First of which, this past weekend, went to go see Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion at the Roxy, which I had never seen before. A very fun time. Have you seen Romy and Michelle, Mike?
I think so, but I don't really remember. I feel like this was some movie I watched like at a summer house with some family, like because it was one of the VHSs at the house that we were rented, you know, kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
And I just like don't remember anything about it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's Romy and Michelle, who are played by Mira Sorvino and Lisa Kudrow. And it's their 10-year high school reunion is coming up. And they decide to kind of create these fake personas to try to impress their old high school like classmates because they're not super impressed with the way their lives have gone since then.
Wow. Unrelatable.
really couldn't couldn't compare. Doesn't make sense. Yeah, no. And so yeah, the two of them like still live together. They're in Los Angeles. They used to live in Tucson, Arizona. They moved out to LA, and yeah, one of them's unemployed. One of them neither of them have boyfriends. They create like a whole new persona for themselves. And this movie really traffics in a lot of very fun absurdist comedy. It really feels like it has the DNA of like, you know, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar and that kind of thing. It all sort of stems back to Romy and Michelle a little bit, which is fun. And Mira Sorvino and Lisa Kudrow are really great together. Janine Garofalo is hilarious in this movie. Alan Cumming is in this, just killing it. There's a moment where he and Romy and Michelle dance at the end that is transcendent. And it's really funny. It's directed by Dave Merkin, who was one of these showrunners in The Simpsons for a couple of years. And I felt that DNA in it too. Like there's that kind of like sort of, there's I think a true core of emotionality to it, but it's couched in just layers and layers of absurdist stuff, which is great. Also, there's a moment where they're watching The Simpsons, and it's Deep Space Homer. It's a great episode.
I'm glad.
But yeah, a really funny movie. I had a good time with it. So yeah, worth checking out if you haven't seen it. And I got to watch it in a pretty packed crowd. So yeah, it was a delight.
Yeah, that sounds good. There's a lot of those. What year did that come out? I feel like it's in the 90s, right?
That was 97. Yeah. And actually recently, as you know, I'm behind on most of my podcasts. As I said before, I'm 9 months behind on almost all my podcasts, except for Screen Drafts, where I'm about 3 years behind, 4 years behind.
Yeah.
And I just listened to their Friends draft, draft of movies of all featuring actors from the show Friends. Mm-hmm. Romy and Michelle was number one on the list.
Ah, look at that. Yeah, there's a lot of those like mid to late 90s kind of just like adult romantic dramedy kind of stuff that I just missed because I was not 10 years old yet. Like I was under 10. Right. So like I just never got around to them. So yeah, maybe we'll deep dive into those one time.
Yeah, there you go. So yeah, Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. Go check it out. I also last night went to watch Ken Russell's The Devils.
Nice.
On the Criterion Channel, which was a real whiplash from Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
So I
finally watched The Devils, which you've seen The Devils, right, Mike?
I have, yeah. When it was on Shudder for like 15 days or 30 days, they had they had it for a very limited time a couple of years ago, and I watched it then.
Yeah, and that's sort of been the thing with The Devils is that, it's a movie that almost immediately upon release, it became like very almost difficult to see. Like, it was heavily censored. It was heavily edited. Like, you know, certain countries banned the movie. It got the X rating, like all that stuff. And in the years since, like whenever it is on streaming, it's usually not streaming for very long. And I don't think, is there like any kind of good physical media release of this movie, or is there like a Blu-ray? Or
I think there was one. I might be out of print now, but I feel like there's was something announced recently. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I know I've seen in particular Justin LaLiberty talking about this movie and how oftentimes the version that gets put on streaming is the like censored, edited, like chopped up version or whatever.
Right,
maybe not chopped up isn't the right word, but with some of the sequences cut out and stuff like that. And that broadly in the last few years, it has shifted from like nearly unwatchable or unobtainable to comes up on streaming every now and then kind of thing, which is good. But yeah, it's a weird like archivist take on how this movie's availability now.
Right. But I'm glad it is at least somewhat available now because I got to watch it, you know.
It's out there.
It's out there. And so Criterion Channel, I believe last month, put out a big collection of Ken Russell movies. And if you haven't seen The Lair of the White Worm, go watch Lair of the White Worm. Fucking rips.
Yeah.
But I finally got to watch The Devils, which stars Vanessa Redgrave and Oliver Reed. Oliver Reed as this priest who is just too hot for the convent.
Too sexy.
Throws the entire convent into a tizzy. And Vanessa Redgrave like starts accusing him of like, you know, having sex with everyone and stuff. And it creates like this whole furor where the entire convent loses their minds and loses their souls to the devil. Right.
Yeah.
And it's really good. I had a good time with it. It's a weird one. Like the movie opens with like a a text on screen that says like, this is based on true events. All of this actually happened. And then you're watching it and you're like, I think some liberties were taken. I don't know.
Yeah, they were real people, historical figures in that they're playing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's such a wild and stylized and weird movie that it really does not feel like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I found it to be really engaging, really intense. You know, it's sort of a horror movie. I mean, it is, but it doesn't really feel like one in the same kind of like what you would expect from a horror movie necessarily. It feels like a movie that like almost shouldn't have been allowed to exist. And it's kind of a miracle that it does.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
it's got big, just a horror movie in the way that blasphemy is horrific. You know, like it's not, I don't think there's particularly horrific things in the movie. I mean, I guess there are.
Sure. I mean, honestly, looks like a good time. Like looked like they were having a great time.
I think they should just have been allowed to fuck, you know? Right. I feel like there's a scene in like classic Ken Russell fashion where it's just like they take him to see the king or something like that, and it's just like a giant orgy while they're like condemning him for his sins of lust while in the background they're just like it's an orgy going on, and you're like, yep. Yeah, Ken Russell, I get it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, really enjoyed it. And yeah, it's available on Criterion Channel now. So if people have not seen The Devils and want to see it before it leaves there and maybe it won't be available for a couple of years or however it works, you should go watch it. It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah, watch some more of those Ken Russell movies. I've only seen that I know of in the Ken Russell-y camp. The Devils, Lair of the White Worm, and Altered States. I really liked Altered States. That movie rules.
I have not seen Altered States. I've seen The Devils, Lair of the White Worm, and I've seen Tommy. He directed the Who's
oh,
Tommy.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Altered States is William Hurt is like this psychologist or whatever or student or researcher or whatever, and he's experimenting with sensory deprivation tanks. You know where you, like you float in the salt water and there's no input and you hallucinate and all that stuff, and he thinks he's accessing like genetic memories from the past, like missing link, you know, kind of primate versions of humans. And then it does Ken Russell-y stuff with that. The movie rules. And I think it's William Hurt's first movie and he's just like an Adonis in it. So watch cool. Altered States.
All right. But yeah, The Devils on Criterion Channel right now. And then also on Criterion Channel, wanted to mention that I watched this, A Woman Under the Influence from 1974, directed by John Cassavetes, starring Gina Rowlands and Peter Falk, Columbo himself. Bringing it all full circle because we talked about Poker Face earlier. Yeah. Are you familiar with the Woman of the Influence, Mike?
Not, I've never seen it, but like kind of just in pop culture passing stuff in Cassavetes and things. I've seen some of his earlier stuff in a film class once. And he rules. So, and I think he worked with Peter Falk a lot, right? And was he married to Gina Rowlands or something?
He was married to Gina Rowlands. Yeah,
Gina Rowlands. Yeah. But I've never seen this movie. So,
okay. Yeah. So I watched this. We showed this at the Roxy and I wasn't able to go. Because it was at the tail end of my like whirlwind Sundance week, and I had just watched like 14 movies in four days, and I was burned out. So I was not able to go to see it at the Roxy, but I did promise my friend who was going, and it's like one of her top 10 favorite movies, that I would watch it. And so I did. And A Woman of the Influence is this drama about this woman who is dealing with some kind of mental issue, but you're not entirely sure what that is. And it's really about her and her husband, Gina Rowlands and Peter Falk, just not really being able to communicate, like knowing there's some kind of problem, but not really being able to tell the other one like what the problem is or like how to communicate with each other and how that impacts their lives. And I think Gina Rowlands is maybe giving the best performance I've ever seen on film.
Wow.
She's unbelievable in this movie. She's so good. Yeah. There's so many weird facial tics that she does, so many different like kind of pitches to her voice, but none of it feels like affected. It all feels very organic. And it feels like there's so much going on with her character and her trying to be a certain way and not being able to be a certain way. And meanwhile, Peter Falk is just like, you know, the schlubby alcoholic husband who, who comes home. And it's really intense at times. It's often very funny. It's a really engaging portrait of mental illness. Yeah, I found this movie really fascinating. So A Woman Under the Influence is the name of the movie. And it's on Criterion Channel right now.
Nice. Yeah, maybe I'll have to check that out. I know there's a lot of those Cassavetes, so Husbands or something like that, I think is another one. And
yeah,
Mikey and Nikki. See, is that a
I believe that's an Elaine May movie.
I think you're right.
Yeah, but he might be in it. He might be in it. Acts a little bit, right?
Yeah. He's in a lot of movies. I haven't seen many of his directorial movies. So
yes, Mikey and Nikki is an Elaine May movie, but John Cassavetes is in it with Peter Falk.
Yeah, That was why. I think that's a big friend of the show, Nick Wormuth movie. I think he really likes that movie.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think I got that Criterion disc a while back, actually, and haven't watched it yet. So, yeah, that should be on the list.
Look at that.
Yeah, there you go. And actually, speaking of, I also ended up watching Night on Earth on Criterion Channel, which is a Jim Jarmusch movie from 1991, an anthology movie with like five different stories that all take place in taxi cabs. Like, it's just about like taxi drivers and their passengers, mm-hmm. like in different places on the earth on the same night. And the first segment is Winona Ryder and Gina Rollins.
Really?
Yes. And I watched that like a week after Woman of the Influence, not knowing that she was in Night on Earth. And Night on Earth, also very good. Really enjoyed it. So yeah, worth watching that too.
Nice. Yeah, that's one that I keep seeing that on the Criterion Channel and be like, one of these days.
I'm going to get around to it.
I'll get around to it.
Yeah. But all right. So I think that's going to wrap this up this week, Mike.
That's it. We talked about all the things.
We talked about all the things. We are thinged out. We have to go and watch the Super Bowl now, I guess.
Yeah, eat a bunch of food. Let's try and stay awake through the Super Bowl.
That's the goal. Last year, I was out of commission by the end of the first quarter.
I don't even remember last year's Super Bowl, honestly.
There you go. I ate too much too fast, and it was just
a struggle.
Like falling asleep on the couch, like, you know, just trying to stay awake for the halftime show, and yeah, it didn't work.
You gotta be up for Usher this year, the singer of our discussions bumper. So
that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. It's all coming together. All right, Mike D, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter and Letterboxd and Blue Sky. If you would like to donate to support the show, you could do that at our Ko-fi page, which is ko-fi.com/MikeAndMikePods. You can also donate $50 on Ko-fi, pick an episode, make us talk about anything you want. We double dog dare you. And if you want merch, we have merch available on our Redbubble, which is MikeAndMikePods.redbubble.com.
Yes, indeed. And you can find me online at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter, MikeSmithFilm on Letterboxd, and Radio Mike Sandwich on Instagram. Thank you so much for listening to Mike Go to the Movies. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike's Cree Show. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. And if you want to contact us, you can tweet at us at Mike and Mike Pod. You can find the rest of our podcast on Rapture Press alongside many other podcasts about kinds of comic books and movie news and all that good stuff. So next week, I think it's time for a Mike Makes Mike Watch, Mike. Is it the February edition?
It is. It's February edition. I will have to pick a new movie because I still haven't been able to find. I think the Baxter might be available to rent on YouTube, actually.
Okay.
But it also says like premium subscription, so I don't know what the hell that means, but
fair enough.
We'll say the Baxter TBD.
Okay, TBD, potentially I'll be watching the Baxter, but Mike D will for sure be watching Liam Neeson in Nonstop, which is a great time. I think you'll enjoy it.
I'll probably have fun.
Yeah, so that'll be happening next week. In the meantime, the Complete Works Season 4 poll is live right now. We have a few days left, so go vote in it. And campaign, tell your friends. Nicole Kidman, Walter Matthau, Kirsten Dunst, Roy Scheider, one of those four people will be the subject of the Complete Works Season 4.
Yes, I'm very excited to see who that is. This lingering question hanging over our heads. Well, the great national nightmare will be over.
Exactly, yes. And finally, we can rest.
Yes.
That is the end of this week's episode of Mike and Mike Go to the Movies. We will see you on the other side.